Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 11 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit for everyone. With me, as always, is my hostess, Erin Paulette. How you doing, Erin?
I am doing all right, Weird. Thanks for asking. The humidity has actually abated for about the past week because we've had a large line of thunderstorms coming in. So, on the one hand, that's great. Low humidity. Love it. On the other hand, thunderstorms every afternoon, freaking the dogs out. And I don't know how it is for you. I don't think you have any pets, but our dogs just literally freak out when there's thunder, and they're just inconsolable. So we've been having to put on their little thunder shirts and give them their doggy tranquilizers and try to convince them that the end of the world is not approaching. Meanwhile, they're giving us that look that, fly, you fools! The end of days is upon us! We must dig to safety!
All right, I know what tranquilizers are, and actually I don't have any pets, but I had a close friend who had a dog that also freaked out in thunderstorms, and as they called it, we give them doggy downers.
Well, we don't do prescription things. Well, because that's expensive, and also we don't want to constantly be giving them drugs. So my mother is really big into herbal tinctures and supplements, and she believes very strongly in something called rock rose, and it comes in a little dropper. It looks almost like an eyedropper, except it's curved and got a little bit of a bulb on it. And apparently you can give it to the dogs, and it acts as a tranquilizer that's over-the-counter, and Mom calls them magic drops. And it worked for some of our dogs. Doesn't work for our newest one, I think, who's just freaking out and doing, like, Superfly Stuka leaps off of our lap.
So what are these thunder shirts you speak of?
Oh, okay. So thunder shirts are basically compression shirts for dogs that secure via Velcro around their neck and under their belly. And the idea is, much like a baby being swaddled, the closeness of the shirt will make the dog feel safe and comforted.
I believe it also works for people. As a matter of fact, just this weekend, I had my sister-in-law's spent the weekend with us. And one of my sister-in-laws actually works with special need children.
Oh, are we talking about light holding therapy?
Yes. Or they've actually got compression shirts. They actually have, I don't know I'd never actually asked her the physical mechanics of how they work, but they put tight things on them and it works.
Well, it works on most of our dogs. Our littlest dog, Daisy, is a Jack Russell Terrier. We've only had her for about a month now, I think. And the thunder shirt doesn't seem to do anything. And she's just constantly jumping into our lap, jumping off of our lap, zooming around the house. It would be cute if it wasn't so disruptive and keeps any of us from getting anything done.
Well, yeah, I think that works for everything. When my daughter was born, we saw the whole swaddling thing and read, like, the happiest baby on the block. And it deals with all of that stuff of bringing the child back to the comfort of the womb situation. And I definitely watched a lot of the YouTube videos and saw, like, some of the babies of just, like, literally get, like, that swaddle on and it's like an off switch. They are just done. I'm happy. Wow. My daughter, not so much. She seemed happy enough, but it could have just been that she's wrapped up in a warm blanket that she's not going to easily fall out of. I don't know. It was not magical. It did work-ish. So I think that works for everybody.
Well, of course, La Weirda is going to be immune to the higher level effects of the baby straitjacket. It just makes sense.
Nothing gets by this child. She sees everything. She knows everything. And It's so much easier to sneak stuff past my wife than this girl.
So your child is Skynet?
Kind of. Though, just like my wife, reverse psychology works extremely well on both of them. But that's because they're stubborn people. And if you tell them, you know, oh, you know, definitely you shouldn't do that. They definitely now want to do that.
Okay. I hope your wife doesn't listen to the podcast, or she might figure out your nefarious scheme.
Oh, even worse, I tell it right to her face and it doesn't make any difference.
Wow, you're confident. Okay.
It's just the truth. Statement of fact. I'd like to take a moment at the top of the show to thank each and every one of our Patreon patrons. Patrons of the Assorted Caliber podcast enjoy the show a few days before everybody else. And once a month, I produce a blooper reel of all the interesting outtakes that I sweep off the cutting room floor. I'd now like to announce another perk for those wonderful people who support us. 1 month from today, I will be picking at random one of our Patreon patrons to receive a stripped lower for a C5 9mm AR-15 from Frontier Armory in Las Vegas, Nevada. Go to the show notes to get all the details on this fine piece of hardware. If you aren't a patron of the show, you now have a little bit of time before the drawing.
Wow, so not just an AR-15 lower, but a 9mm lower. Now, when you won a lower at the NRA annual meeting, I didn't know it was a 9mm. Is this the same one, or did you trade it in for credit? How's this going on?
This, I believe, is the same one. I, honestly speaking, I wasn't paying a whole heck of a lot of attention because I heard AR-15 lower, and I know that I can't get that in Massachusetts, so... Mm. I let them know, and immediately I thought, well, what am I going to do about this? What am I going to do? And they said you could give you store credit. And I said, oh, that's cool. And I went, I wonder what they have for store credit. And then I realized, what am I bothering with that? There are these wonderful people that support us and the podcast. So let me help them. I can't get this AR lower, but you can.
Wow, Weird. That is really generous of you. And... not at all a blatant attempt to get more people to subscribe. I approve.
Not at all a blatant attempt to get more people to subscribe. And it's not. I want to help the people that have been here from the very beginning as get more people to subscribe. Because I do want more people to join in the fun and give them love.
Changing the topic to something that isn't fun and doesn't have a lot of love. Florida's at it again. Weird, have you heard the recent kerfuffle about how the Florida Department of Agriculture did not conduct background checks on concealed weapons licensees for over a year?
I have heard about this, and it really got me scratching my head. Is that actually how it went down?
Well, like a lot of things in the media, it's factually correct, but it's not true. Or maybe I have that backwards. Allow me to explain. The very short version is, yes, that's correct, but it's nowhere near the apocalypse that it's made out to be. Now, I have read the Inspector General's report on the incident. It's only 10 pages. It's in very plain English. Anyone can read. If you can read a law, you can read and understand this. And so if you want to read exactly what happened, go ahead to the show notes and see for yourself. But the way the press is making the sound is that for over a period of a year, Florida was not performing background checks on people who were applying for a concealed carry license. And out of the hundreds of thousands of people who got their licenses in that time period, who knows how many criminals and terrorists might have gotten through. Oh, horror. Now, the press is making this out to be a big, horrible deal. And it is noteworthy, don't get me wrong. But I think they are inflating it for hysterical purposes. And the main reason for it, at least in my opinion, is because the Florida Department of Agriculture is currently being run by Adam Putnam, and he is running for governor when Rick Scott gets booted out due to term limits. Needless to say, Adam Putnam is Republican, and nearly all of the newspapers in Florida are liberal. So I think that it's a political hatchet job to a certain extent. So here is what really happened, as best I can communicate to you. It's very complicated. It reads like, oh, I don't know if it's necessarily a soap opera, but it's clearly a case of someone screwed up very, very thoroughly, and there were lots of miscommunication going on. And it's all there in the Inspector General report. So, there is a woman within the Department of Licensing whose job is to log into a database and coordinate with NICS, the National Instant Check System, when someone applies for a license and gets a rejection for some reason. And anyone who's bought a gun and filled out the 4473 and gotten a hold from NICS knows that a lot of times it's just a screw-up, or you've got a name that's close to someone else's, or someone transposed a digit of your social security number, and this is just a backstop. And this woman had a problem back in, I think it was September of 2016, where she couldn't log into NICS. And she contacted tech support about it, and tech support replied back, and then she forgot to follow up, and just never followed up for over a year. And this was really only noticed when, I don't know if it was her superior or her boss's boss, I don't remember at this point, because I'm terrible with names, but someone realized, you know, we haven't been getting contacted by NICS. I wonder why this is. We should probably check. And when the woman was confronted by this, she got a look on her face, and I don't know if this was, oh crap, I've been found out, or oh crap, I had completely forgotten about it.
I've left the gas on.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, she just hadn't been checking this for over a year. This is bad. They fired her for it. They went back and reviewed all of the kickbacks that should have been reviewed, because since she didn't talk to NICS, the ones that threw an error were just approved. Where this differs from the panic-mongering Tampa Bay report is that Tampa Bay focuses on the fact that there were 268,000 applications that were approved from 2016 through 2017. And you hear that and you think, oh my god, nearly 270,000 applications, how many bad guys get through? The problem is, when you do the math, as Miguel did on Gun-Free Zone, that equates to one person entering the application, I think it was like two every minute for months on end. In other words, getting nothing else done. And it was later revealed from other sources that most of the background checks were being done. It was just pop-ups from NICS saying, hey, you know, maybe you should check on this. We don't know about this guy. And so it wasn't 268,000. It was a much, much lower number. It was 365.
Essentially, the state of Florida doesn't have just one person as the go-between between the federal system and Florida's state system.
Exactly. There are, I think, three different types of background checks. So the background checks were being done, and this wasn't a case of yes or no. This was a case of, hey, this is kind of odd. You maybe should check this person out. And those were the people who were approved when they shouldn't have been. And so 365 applicants out of, what, 370,000 is 0.14%. It's a really, really tiny number. And of those, 74 were cleared and 291 still had disqualifiers. Doesn't mean they were criminal. Doesn't mean they should never have gotten that license. It just means, needed more follow-ups. And so those licenses, which had been issued, were suspended, not revoked, suspended so that more investigation could be done.
And even then, if they were people that didn't pass it, I don't know if you're like me. Specifically for me, it's tradesmen, because if someone's working on the appliances in my basement, also known as my armory, people quickly realize that I'm a gun nut when there's a shelf that is just ammo.
Yeah,
they realize I'm a gun nut, and especially if they are themselves a gun nut, of which I would say, at least in the state of Massachusetts, tradesmen tend to skew much more to the gun nut side. And so very often I will be sitting there having gun conversations with tradespeople. But I've had a bunch of them suddenly say, oh, yeah, no, I went in and to get to buy a gun. And yeah, I got denied and realized that, oh, yeah, back when I was in college, I got caught with a joint and I did a plea so that I didn't have to do any time and just community service or all that. And it all went away, so to speak, until suddenly now fast forward, you know, 10, 15, 20 years when I realize, oh, yeah, I'd like to buy a gun, and realize, oh, yeah, that plea that I did was pleading to a felony. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of people that have what I would call BS felonies, where used to be felonies were serious antisocial behaviors that were people that you did not want to associate with. I don't think that's the case now. Now, just because someone is a felon doesn't mean that they are a horrible bloodthirsty monster anymore.
Yeah, it's a malum prohibitum felony as opposed to a malum in se felony.
Exactly. Martha Stewart is a felon because she committed perjury. She should have said no comment is the bottom line for her case. Like, I don't even know if she was actually lying or she just had no idea the specifics of what she answered wrong to the question. But she is a felon. Does this mean I like Martha Stewart? No, I think her cooking is terrible and I don't like her shows. But would I feel unsafe if I got stuck in an elevator with Martha Stewart? No, not at all. As a matter of fact, if Martha Stewart felt a little unsafe being stuck in an elevator with me, I wouldn't blame her. This seems a lot like Much Ado About Nothing.
It is. And I think this goes back to what I was saying earlier with the Tampa Bay Times doing a hatchet job, because he's running for governor and there is this urge in Florida to turn it from purple to blue. The Democrats really want this blue wave. And to be honest, this newspaper has a tendency of skewing the truth, let's say. For example, the Tampa Bay Times also took effort to take data on Stand Your Ground cases and denounce the law as racist, despite the fact that its own data revealed that Stand Your Ground favored black people by an almost 3-to-1 ratio.
That is something that I see a lot when I'm doing the weird audio fisk as well, is people will cite sources and the sources will directly contradict them.
Yeah. And so really it's a case of, oh, we can use this against someone who's running for governor under the Republican ticket. Let's make it as inflammatory as we can. It was an unfortunate thing that happened. She was incompetent. She didn't do her job. She didn't do her job for over a year, and there's a fair amount of, well, I thought, well, why didn't you, well, we could have, you know, the kind of BS that you would expect, and she was held responsible for it. She was fired for it. And so, in that regard, the system worked. But saying that Adam Putnam is responsible for this, technically he is, because he's the supervisor, and the boss is always responsible for everything the subordinate does. But it's a stretch.
There's only so far that'll go.
Yeah. I mean, this is perhaps not as close as holding the general responsible for what a private does, but it's pretty close. And so it's just a whole lot of hot air that looks really bad, but when you actually look at the data, it was a thing. It was dumb. I'm not too worried, because I've gone through the application for the Florida concealed carry license, and I've received it. And part of that was being fingerprinted. This is not something you knowingly do if you are aware that you are a felon. Because I went down to the police station, had my picture taken by the mugshot camera, I just didn't have the little placard in front of me, and I was I basically was processed. They just didn't charge me with anything and put me in jail. But it was the exact same thing. And then they signed on the form, they handed me the prints, and then I put it in the mail. You know, felons don't go to this degree of risk in order to get a concealed carry license, because it's got way too much involvement with the cops. So anyone who is disqualified from getting one most likely has a BS felony like you just talked about.
Yeah, I have a Massachusetts concealed carry license and a Florida concealed carry license. And yeah, both of them, you know, very much. And I've been arrested. And so, and both of them are very, very similar processes when it comes to the, yeah, getting your picture taken and filling out lots of forms and getting your fingerprints done. Thankfully, I was arrested on BS charges and the charges were dropped. So anyone concerned about that, again, also noted that I have two valid concealed carry permits and an FFL. So. I'm not concerned.
And now let's turn it over to our general purpose egghead. Last week he gave us an introduction to ham radio. This week he talks about the various licenses you can get to be a ham operator and what that means to the FCC.
Hello everybody, and welcome to week 2 of the general purpose egghead. I am the egghead, and this week we will be talking about how to get your ham radio license, and some of the basic rules for operation. So before we get started, let's cover why you might want to get a license. It is actually legal to listen on any ham radio frequency, or to my knowledge, any frequency for that matter, without a license. But if you want to transmit, you are only allowed to transmit on certain frequencies, and you need a license for that. There is an exception to that a lot of people in the preparedness community like to talk about, which is that if someone's life is in imminent danger, you're allowed to use whatever equipment you may have at hand that's best likely to get them help. But like any other skill, if you've never done something before, you're going to be bad at it the first time. And running a ham radio station or a radio station of any kind that transmits is a lot more difficult than you might think. So if you want to actually be skilled at it and understand what you're doing, you're going to need a license in order to get that experience. Also worth keeping in mind is that amateur radio is actually really fun, especially if you maintain some sense of wonder about just how cool technology is. I find it remarkable that I can throw a wire in a tree and run something off of a car battery and communicate with someone on the other side of the world without anything in between us. I just find that technically fascinating, and if you do as well, you're going to find a lot to like about ham radio. So that said, there are some disadvantages to getting into amateur radio. And the first is, like any hobby, it costs time and money. You can cut down the amount of money it costs by working on your own equipment, but then you're going to spend more time on it, so you're going to pay one way or another, either in money or time. And the other one, especially for people like me who are particularly concerned about privacy, is that in getting your license, you are put on a publicly searchable database with your call sign, your name, and your mailing address. Now, I do say mailing address specifically, because it doesn't have to be your physical street address, it just has to be an address that people can reach you at if they want to send you mail, specifically the FCC, if they have any issues with interference you may be causing. They need to know who to contact. And a lot of people in the amateur radio community will use this database in order to send each other QSO cards, which are more or less postcards saying, hey, I talked to you. So I think it's also important to keep in mind that we do live in an era where a $5.99 search on the internet somewhere is going to turn up somebody's name and address anyway. So it's not a tremendous disadvantage, but it is there. So before we get into the types of licenses, we're going to cover some of the basic knowledge and a couple of the rules and regulations. One of the first things that's going to happen after you get your license is you're going to be issued a call sign, which is a series of letters and a number that identifies you. It is by default randomly assigned by the FCC, but you can request custom ones like a vanity license plate. And it actually serves the same purpose as a license plate, to identify who you are and verify that you do have a license. But instead of displaying this license on a vehicle, you actually are required to announce your call sign at the beginning and the end of every transmission, and at least once every 10 minutes while you are transmitting. The idea behind this is to ensure that you can identify any signal on the airwaves, so if it's causing harmful interference to somebody, they know who to contact to ask to turn their radio off. And this brings us to the second point, which is probably the most important. You are expressly forbidden from causing interference to anybody else, on purpose at least. And if you find out that you are causing interference, you are required to try and fix that, whether that be stop transmitting or move to a different frequency or do something else to maybe reduce power or reduce the amount of bandwidth you're using in order to minimize your impact on other users. No one owns any particular section of the airwaves, but you do need to be courteous to people. And that brings us to our next point, which is that you have to remember that you are a guest on the airwaves. There is no freedom of speech here. FCC regulations forbid transmitting music of any kind, even singing happy birthday. Foul language is not allowed. And it is technically not forbidden, but it is discouraged to talk about controversial topics. People generally keep to pleasantries and discussions of propagation conditions, equipment, and how many stations they've worked. In addition, you are not allowed to do any broadcasts, and a broadcast is defined as a signal that's sent out to nobody in particular. It's just addressed to whom it may concern. As an amateur radio operator, you're expected to try and communicate with other amateur radio operators on a one-to-one basis. You're allowed to call for whoever may be listening to speak to you, but you're not allowed to go on maybe a 10 or 20 minute spiel about whatever you want to talk about in the manner of a radio show. Your goal is supposed to be to make contacts with other people and have discussions with them. One other thing to keep in mind is that while most people are used to thinking of radios as operating in particular channels, amateur radios typically don't do that. There is one particular band of frequencies called the 60 meter band that uses channels, but on every other amateur radio band, you just have a specific bandwidth, a certain space in the radio frequency spectrum that you are allowed to use. And you just kind of scroll up and down in that space to listen to stations wherever they happen to be. There are no particular channels, just width. So you do have to be careful of things like how wide your signal is. For example, a typical voice signal is roughly 3 kilohertz wide, and I'm only allowed to transmit in a certain band that might be 3 or 400 kilohertz wide. So I have to be careful that if I'm at the very edge of the band, I need to know how wide my signal is so that I don't go over the edge and find myself in violations of FCC regulations. There are also regulations within each particular band about what you can do in certain sections. There are certain sections that are Morse code only, for example, though these are mostly held just by gentlemen's agreement rather than by actual legislation or regulation. There's a lot of other regulations that we could talk about, but since you're going to cover more of those in your actual license exam for your first and easiest to get license, I'm not going to go in any more detail. I just wanted to give you a general flavor of what it's like to be an amateur radio operator. So with all that covered, let's talk about the types of licenses and which one you might want to get. The first level and the easiest to get is the technician's license. The exam for this one is fairly short and it's very basic. Really all you have to know is basic safety rules and regulations. They just want to make sure that you're not deliberately causing interference or harming yourself or others. Now, as you would expect from a license that's the easiest to get, it also is the most limited. You are mostly restricted to VHF and UHF spectrums, which, if you recall from last week, are typically fairly short range. You are allowed a particular very narrow segment of the 40 meter and 80 meter bands, which are capable of very long range, but you are only allowed to use Morse code, which is an obstacle in and of itself. With that said, the technician's license is very easy to get into. VHF and UHF equipment is fairly inexpensive and very common, with the least expensive radio being right around $40, and your license exam is very inexpensive as well, at maybe $15. So you can get on the air for less than $60. But if you want a little bit more bang for your buck, you're going to want to get the general license, which is, in my opinion, where things get interesting. This gives you privileges on all ham radio bands, so you can sample a little bit of everything that amateur radio has to offer. There is one license level above general, which is the amateur extra license. And really all that gets you is a little bit more elbow room. With an amateur extra license, there are small segments of the band that you are allowed to transmit on that general licenses are not. You get a little bit wider area, so on days when the band is particularly crowded and there's a lot of activity, you might appreciate a section of the band that's a little bit quieter with less interference. So after you've selected what kind of license you want, the next step is to take your exam. And to do this, you're going to go through the ARRL, which is the Amateur Radio Relay League. They are sort of an equivalent to the NRA for amateur radio. They are a membership-based organization that is not a part of the government, but training that they offer is recognized by the government. They also have study guides that they publish that will help you study for these exams. This is the usual route and probably the best option. It's not actually the route I chose, though. The exams themselves are based on a publicly available pool of questions, so you do know every possible question that could be on the exam. So there is a resource that I used. It's a study guide by a guy. His call sign is KB6NU. And what he does is he takes all of the questions that are on the exam and restates them as lists of facts. And then he reorganizes them into a logical order and adds explanation in between them. So it basically reads like an extremely short book with everything you need to know and nothing you don't. One thing to be aware of, though, is that this does basically teach you to the test and does not give you a thorough understanding of the principles behind it. So it is entirely possible to get in over your head later on and be lacking in basic background knowledge. So if you're going to go this route, be sure to try and study in other methods as well. Once you've finished studying, the process is simple. You just go onto the ARRL's website and find an exam in your area. You show up, you take your test, you hopefully pass, and then you just wait for your license to show up on the FCC's ULS online database. Once it does, you have your license and you're ready to operate. That wraps it up for this week, so be sure to listen next week when we will talk about VHF and UHF radios, how to use them, and some recommendations for getting started.
This is such a good segment. I'm really enjoying it.
It is.
Ham radio is one of those things that is interesting for me to learn about, but I don't have the time or the money or the space for the equipment to get into what is very definitely a very deep rabbit hole. This is one of those things, well, as I like to talk about on the prepping blog, you can't do everything by yourself. If you try, you will go nuts, because you have to sleep at some point, and in a disaster situation, when things are really bad, that whole without rule of law, you really want someone to watch while you sleep, to stand guard. And so that's why a lot of preppers, it's why most preppers, the smart ones at least, believe in having a prepping group or the tribe. And so for me, well, I can't get into ham radio, but it's really good to know someone who does, because one person can do guns, the other person can do comms, the other person can do, I don't know, constructing, hunting. Everyone has a specialty, and that way all of your bases are covered, and you don't go nuts trying to do everything. But yeah, if you're at all interested in communication during a disaster, ham radio is the way to go.
And I like the idea of the, he gave a good argument that I hadn't thought of before, which is the fact that you don't want to be figuring out ham when you desperately need a radio. So even if you don't like the idea of getting the license, it's a good way to get your practice in.
Absolutely.
Now for a shift from his usual cryptocurrency talk, Savage is going to talk about a very interesting AR-15 modification he's working on called the DB5000. I'll let him explain to you what that is and what it stands for.
Well, hello, ACP listeners out there. This is Jack Savage, and welcome to the Savage segment. Well, sometimes it goes down, but mostly it goes up. Which way did the crypto roller coaster swing? Well, we're not going to talk about it this week. I'm actually going to be pivoting slightly. You know, I've spent the last number of weeks, I don't know how many we've done so far, but a number of weeks talking about cryptocurrency, and I think I've done a fairly good job. Well, scratch that. I've done a job of trying to bring you up to speed as to where I am currently at in my knowledge base. I haven't done the best job, but I've tried to give you a basic overview of everything you kind of need to know to get started in the cryptocurrency space. And of course, I plan on updating to keep bringing you news on the new things that are coming up, especially this month in June, which is going to be extremely exciting. But, you know, like anybody else, I have other interests, and I'd really like to talk to you about a project I'm working on that has been 5 years in the making. Oh my God, it has taken so long, but I've finally gotten to the point where it is almost done. So you guys will see the finished product, not necessarily here, but over on the WeLikeShooting.com, which is the other group of people that I work with most of the time, on the We Like Shooting podcast and the We Like Shooting videos YouTube page. So the project I've been working on is affectionately referred to by me as the DB5000, otherwise known as the Dick Butt 5000. To anybody who's been following us in the Patreon Facebook page, I posted a video earlier, and what it basically amounts to is a remote-controlled turret. As far back as I can remember, I think when I was a little kid watching Aliens for the first time, one of the things that really inspired me, just blew my young mind, was during that scene where the Space Marines landed and they had to secure the area. And one of the ways they did that was by taking these remote control and semi-autonomous auto turrets, you know, these auto tracking guns, putting them in these hallways, these choke points, and having them shoot up the bad guy aliens. And then not too far after that came the movie The Jackal, starring Bruce Willis, where he hilariously blew off Jack Black's arm in an attempt to shoot a pack of cigarettes out of his hands. So the idea had been in my head for such a long time, but it had been out of reach. One of the many reasons something like that can be out of reach is it can feel a little bit intimidating. You know, sometimes you think about an idea and it can feel like it's so overwhelming that you can't accomplish it, mostly because there's the thought of having to build every single piece of the puzzle individually, and most people just don't have that amount of knowledge on them. I know I don't. But fortunately for us, a lot of people have already built and created all of the individual little components that make up the entire system, that if you're able to find one piece here and another piece over there, and oh, there's one over there that will just fit in the right way, that'll come together as a singular system and create this idea that I've had for the longest time. So coming back to it, the Dick Butt 5000. So what is it? So let's start at the base model. The base of it is a remote-controlled camera mount. So it's a Vicon Industries camera mount, and these things were designed back in, like, I want to say the 70s. They are old as dirt, but these things are also rock solid. They have a screw drive to gear motor, and the lockup between them is extremely tight. These camera mounts are meant for very small up to very fast movements, and to be able to be locked into place without any kind of wiggle whatsoever. The particular mount that I was able to acquire for free, fortunately, during a demolition project, is able to hold a 40-pound load limit. So it's designed to hold a 40-pound camera, lens, and everything that goes along with it. And it has variable speeds and an XY axis. So it's able to go left, right, tilt up, and tilt down in about 180 degrees both directions. So when I saw that for the first time, I knew that is exactly what I needed to start my build off of. And if you are on eBay, sometimes you can find like the Vicon control units or the cables associated with it or the camera mounts themselves. It's one of those things where you kind of have to do a little bit of detective work, but you can eventually find all the pieces and put it together so that you can have the working remote control mount. And that's half the work right there. Almost everything else after that is simple. So the second part was, how do you power the thing? Well, it's generally powered through an AC power supply. But if you're going to be going out onto the range, you're not going to be finding many AC power supplies out on a public land. You know, they don't have any plug-ins out there. It's just you, dirt, or a hillside. So I had to figure out a way to convert DC power to AC power. So what I needed was an AC inverter and a battery. It's a relatively simple thing to accomplish. Generally, deep cycle batteries are the best because they're designed to be discharged and recharged fairly often. They're also called marine batteries. You can find them in boating shops or battery shops that sell marine deep cycle batteries. And those are really good ones to use. They're meant to use a lot of cycles so they can, again, be charged and discharged quite often. So after I got the camera mount and the camera mount power supply figured out, now I've got a way to control the turret. So what are the other components that need to be worked on? Well, first, you have to figure out how do you attach the firearm to the camera mount in the first place. Well, the cool thing about the camera mount is that it had a number of slots lined up in a row, kind of like M-Lock mounts. So I was looking around on eBay, and I happened to find sling swivel quick detach rail mounts. And these specific ones, if you look them up on eBay and can find them, they're very easy to disassemble. There's a crossbar that goes over the Picatinny rail connector, and that's the crossbar that is used in the quick detach mount. The whole quick detach mount can be unscrewed and pulled apart, and then what you can do is pull out the sling swivel mount, and that leaves a hole in the middle of the Picatinny mount. And what that hole allows you to do is run a bolt through it and attach it to those slots that are in line in the camera mount. And then you simply reassemble the quick detach mount, use the rail from whatever firearm you're going to be using to space the mounts apart so that they can be able to hold down the firearm and it's lined up properly. Then you just tighten everything down, and now you found a way to attach any rifle with a rail on it to the remote controlled arm. So we've got the arm, we've got the firearm, now we need to figure out how to shoot it. So how do you pull the trigger? Well, you can pull the trigger manually, or you can get a little bit creative. And this is one of the issues that I had to really look long and hard to try and find a solution for. I tried automatic door locks, I tried different kinds of solenoids. Nothing was really fitting the bill until I was searching around on Reddit one day, and I happened across a post, and it was the most random post ever. It showed somebody had looked under the hood of a van, and under the hood of that van was mounted a semi-automatic shotgun, and attached to the trigger of the shotgun and to the hood was an electric car door lock. When I tried the solenoid, they just don't have enough physical strength to pull on a 6-pound trigger. Unless you get up to really expensive solenoid motors, they just won't have enough power. But an automatic door lock uses a different system entirely, and it works great. There's a video out there by Colin Furs you can look up on how to make a electronic trigger for your Nerf guns. But hey, guess what? It works for real guns too. I picked up myself an automatic car door lock. It comes with a transfer bar that is used to actuate, you know, your car door lock, that little nub that sticks up in your door that you push down or pull up. And you have to bend that transfer bar in order so that it will hook around the trigger. So now you have a trigger finger basically sticking out from your automatic door lock. So then you have to figure out a way to mount that door lock to your firearm or to some kind of frame. Well, I found out that on my particular buttstock, there is a hole at just the right distance. On my adjustable buttstock, if I lock it into a certain position, there's a hole that will line up exactly with one of the screw holes that fits into the automatic door lock. So all you really need at that point is a bolt, a crush washer, a washer, and a wing nut. And you run those things through the automatic door lock and the buttstock, and you tighten it down so that the automatic door lock is attached to the buttstock and the transfer bar hooks around the trigger. So then, once that's done, you have to hook it up to a button. What you're going to be looking for on eBay is a temporary on-off button, and it's going to be one that works on a 12-volt system. You'll have to look up the details. I can't really explain it over the radio. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's something you'll just have to watch when I make the video. But you'll have to hook it up in a way so that when you press the button down, it actuates the trigger and pulls only once, and when you release the button, it relaxes and goes back. Now, this is the really important thing because you cannot legally have an electronic trigger that will pull the trigger more than once per push of the button. You can only legally have an electronic trigger that pulls the trigger once every time you push the button, and it lets go of the trigger every time you let go of the button. If it pulls multiple times, you have then created a machine gun, and the ATF is going to be knocking on your door and shooting your puppers, and you're going to have a really bad day. Fortunately, this is not like that. It's specifically designed for one pull per one push of the button only. So that's a major thing to keep in mind. Don't mess around with that. Keep it nice and simple. Don't make it easily convertible to fully automatic, it has to be locked into a way where it can only actuate the trigger once per push of the button. So now we have a way to move the gun. We have the gun mounted to the way to move the gun. We have the way to shoot the gun, but we don't have the way to aim the gun. Well, there is a way to aim the gun, and there's a way to aim the gun really cool. And that way, it's called the ATN X-Sight 2 HD. This is a new type of, I'm going to call it a video scope, because that's really what it is. It's a video camera with a processor that allows it to act like a scope. It's got a ballistic calculator. It's got a GPS unit in it. It's got Wi-Fi that can broadcast video to any tablet or mobile phone. It's got everything in the kitchen sink inside of it. So what that allows you to do is mount that sight onto your firearm, which is mounted to the electronic robotic arm. And then once that's done, you turn it on, you hook it up to your tablet or to your phone, and you sight it in. So that's the point I'm at right now. I haven't had a chance to go out and shoot this thing yet, but I am chomping at the bit. I am so excited, and I just wanted to let you guys know where I am. This is a project that has been such a long time in the making, and I've finally been able to acquire the last piece of the puzzle, which was the ATN X-Sight. And from my preliminary experience with it, I would highly suggest you go get one. The one I got is the 3-14 zoom one, and you can go find them on Brownells. For under $500, you are getting a scope that will take on any scope up to and over $1,000. It's like a new evolution in optics technology, and it blows everything else out of the water. So that's all I got for this week. I hope you guys were entertained and excited about the project as I am. Moving forward, I'm going to be talking about a lot of other subjects, but of course, I'm always going to come back and touch on crypto whenever any kind of major news hits to keep you guys in the know. So thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
So yeah, the DB5000.
Yeah. I don't know why he called it that. I really wish he'd explained why.
Yeah, I wish he had too. If you go to the show notes, I've got a video of this thing, of him trying it out and using the automatic door lock actuator to pull the trigger. And it's, if you look, it's got a logo at the bottom of the turret that... don't let your kids see this link, or at least don't put it on full screen for the kids in the room. But yeah, I was actually getting a little bit uncomfortable going, oh man, am I going to let him say the word dick butt that many times on this show with a clean rating? But meanwhile, I'm like, oh, I'm the one that introduces our private investigator as the house dick. So I guess it's okay.
But you know what isn't okay? He made me feel old because he said he watched Aliens as a kid. Now, I don't know about you, Weird. I think we're roughly the same age, but I saw Aliens in college.
Oh, see, I was watching Aliens in high school. We're a few years apart. I was watching Aliens in high school. But on top of that, if I remember correctly, the sentry turrets didn't make an appearance until they released the director's cut, which
See, that's what I thought, but I wasn't sure because I can't trust my crappy memory anymore.
And I'm not 100% sure either. I could be wrong because ever since I got the... What I have is the 25th anniversary DVD collection of the Aliens films, and it's got director's cuts of the all of the first four films, or the four contiguous films, and not the prequels, and whether those are good or not, I don't want to dive too deep. I'm a super duper Aliens nerd, so we don't want to go down this rabbit hole right now. This is a Second Amendment podcast. I'll start an Aliens podcast sometime later. But yeah, the sentry turrets, I believe, only made the appearance in the director's cut, and I'm not sure when that showed up. I know it showed up before the director's cut of the original film, which that came out in 2009, if I remember correctly. No, it was the 25th anniversary, so that was...
All I know is that I saw it in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And I saw the director's... Well, I don't know if I saw the director's cut. I saw the ones with the sentry turrets in the early 90s.
I don't know how that works out, but I trust your judgment on that. I will say, to show a little bit of my age, Aliens is easily the most watched film of my entire life, because I used to come home from school and I would pop that in, watch that, and then start my homework. And so much that my recorded off of HBO VHS cassette of it was held together in several places with scotch tape, because the film had been worn so thin that it had snapped in several instances.
Wow. That's hardcore.
Yeah. Oh, I love that series so much. Now we have an audio fisk from Jack Savage's gay and slightly more conservative brother, Dan Savage. Okay, I kid. R. Savage is no relation to Dan Savage of the Savage Love Cast, nor Michael Savage of the Savage Nation, or Savage Arms of Westfield, Massachusetts. But unlike those other Savages, Dan Savage is very anti-gun. And this is the subject of the latest weird audio fisk. This week's weird audio fisk is Dan Savage of one of my favorite podcasts, the Savage Love Cast. While I don't agree with Dan at all when it comes to guns, I do love his show and listen to it every week. The show is a sex advice podcast, but Dan often talks politics in the opening of the show, and when he talks guns, I have to go after him. This rant was recorded shortly after the shooting in Parkland, Florida.
We didn't do anything after Sandy Hook, where 21st graders were mowed down in their classrooms along with six of their teachers. And we didn't do anything after the Pulse nightclub massacre, where 49 people were killed and 58 others were wounded by a lunatic with an AR-15. And we didn't do anything after Las Vegas, where 58 concertgoers were killed and 851 people were injured, again by a maniac with an AR-15.
This has become a common talking point of anti-gunners, and it is a blatant lie. After Sandy Hook, Michael Bloomberg first rolled out his pet universal background checks bill to the U.S. Senate. Given that the killer at Sandy Hook murdered his own mother to steal her firearms, which in fact were all legally purchased with a background check, and in the initial bill it defined hunting and target shooting with family and friends, as well as gifting firearms to friends and family, as illegal transfers, the bill got off to a rocky start. The final bill was filled with so many exemptions that it likely wouldn't have been very different from how private sales are currently conducted in America. After Pulse, similar bills were floated, but this time the shooter was an armed security guard and had undergone some very extensive background checks that didn't reveal any problems. Members of Congress held a sit-in temper tantrum to try to get their boilerplate agenda voted on. The end result was laws that prevent future childish behavior. After Las Vegas, the standard boilerplate was floated, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives were charged to reconsider their classification of bump stocks. And several states have outright banned the devices, including Florida, in the wake of a shooting where no such device was used. So the anti-gunners say, we didn't do anything after, when in reality, after every event, anti-gun groups do the exact same pointless anti-gun boilerplate that would have done nothing to prevent the tragic events. And that agenda is shot down by our political process. I guess it's better to claim they did nothing than to admit to total failure of a structured agenda that is both blind and tone deaf.
Maybe it'll be different this time, because the victims, the survivors at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, are calling bullshit on the NRA and the president the NRA owns and the members of Congress the NRA owns.
Well, since I'm recording this months after Dan recorded his rant, I could say yes, it was different. Well, a little bit. See, Dan opened his rant talking about the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Before that event had even happened, Michael Bloomberg had hired Shannon Watts, a corporate communications and public relations expert, to start framing up a new anti-gun push that would distance the corporate anti-gun lobby from Bloomberg's increasingly unpopular name. After the news broke that there was a shooting in Connecticut, Shannon Watts sprang into action with a laughable story about her simply being a stay-at-home mom who started a Facebook group that just so happened to be assisted by anti-gun billionaire Michael Bloomberg. And it just so happened that this coincidentally tied in with his rebranding of Mayors Against Illegal Guns into Every Town for Gun Safety. Of course, it's such a contrived story that we know Watts was working for Bloomberg the whole time, and her plan was to soften the image of the corporate anti-gun lobby, now rebranded as Gun Violence Prevention. And like all anti-gun actions, it must be done in the wake of a horrible event when emotions run high and hopefully better logic can be subverted. One day after the shooting in Parkland, representatives for Everytown were contacting students who had expressed anti-gun views in the news interviews. and these kids were coached and promoted by these media professionals. The March for Our Lives was created, a division of Everytown, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg. But this time, Bloomberg didn't make the Parkland kids Everytown employees, or make the Washington March an exclusive Everytown event. This meant many of his newfound warriors for the anti-gun agenda, like David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez, went wildly off message and created a PR nightmare of their own. And the March on Washington was a hodgepodge of left-wing agenda items, and the gun control agenda got horribly diluted. So the tactics were different, but the results were the same. Oh, and ironic that Dan talks about how the NRA owns Congress and the president, while all these actions were carried out by a billionaire outspending the NRA. Dan then goes to play some clips for one of the first major speeches by Emma Gonzalez.
Politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this, we call BS. We say that tough, they say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS.
This speech was likely written by an employee of Everytown, which is wholly owned by billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who was tossing more money into Florida than the NRA was. And this event was carried out in a gun-free zone by a sick and violent individual who is known to authorities in the school, local law enforcement, and the FBI. And he even made open threats to shoot up a school months before the shooting. All the gun control in the world won't do anything if the most basic laws aren't being enforced and known dangerous people are allowed to roam about unsupervised.
They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS!
Well, in the case of most spree shootings, this is true. The shooter makes their presence known, and at some point, a good guy responds and the shooting ends very quickly. If the responder is an armed citizen who is in the area being targeted, the events often end so quickly that it isn't even classified by the FBI or the anti-gun groups as a spree killing. This, of course, leads to a catch-22, which is one of the talking points of the corporate anti-gun agenda. No armed citizen has stopped a mass shooting! Technically true, because if the armed citizen is in the right place at the right time, the shooting is prevented, and technically there was never a mass shooting to stop. If it is like the events in Sutherland Springs where the armed citizen engaged after he had left the church, while he very well may have prevented future loss of life, as the killer was still armed and had ammo in his car where he died, the actions of the brave citizen Stephen Williford did not prevent a mass shooting. But in the case of Parkland, Florida, the armed resource officer heard the shots in the school, and he hid outside where it was safe. When the Broward County Sheriff's deputies responded, they hid behind their cars, where it was safe. Eventually, when the killer dropped his guns and tried to slip out with his fellow students, he was arrested by men with guns. Ironically, every one of her points is BS.
They say guns are just tools like knives and are as dangerous as cars. We call BS!
Except that's right. Guns are way less dangerous than cars. In 2016, there were 37,000 deaths by auto accident. That's pretty close to the 36,000 deaths by gunfire in the United States. Except the majority of those deaths are suicides. And the bulk of the rest are homicides. There were less than 500 accidental deaths by firearm in 2015. So more people are accidentally killed by cars than are killed by guns on purpose.
They say that no laws could have been able to prevent the hundreds of senseless tragedies that have occurred. We call BS!
Well, in part, they're right. There are places with insanely draconian gun laws that have mass shootings. And there is really no place on the planet where shootings never occur, no matter how illegal the guns are. There certainly might be some laws that might prevent some of these events, such as eliminating gun-free zones that the spree shooters seek out and embolden criminals. Of course, we could also enforce the laws we have on the books. The killer in Parkland had so many red flags that were ignored, he easily could have been in a jail cell that day, or getting the mental care he obviously needed. But the anti-gunners focus on guns because their goals are not public safety, but banning guns. So they say nothing about Broward County Sheriff's cowardice and incompetence. They say nothing about the FBI's incompetence. And certainly they say nothing about the school promise program that helped conceal the killer's problems. They say, we need more gun laws! Never mind that if the killer had one of these magical gun violence restraining orders that the anti-gunners are so in love with now,
He still could have acquired a moving truck or learned how to make a pipe bomb or just started swinging like crazy with a $15 machete from Home Depot.
That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS!
Sorry, Emma. That's just reality. When I was your age, I thought I knew how the system worked, too. And I really didn't. And when you look at registration numbers, it appears I was an anomaly in my age group because I went to vote in every town, state, and federal election after my 18th birthday. But it turns out that less than half of the eligible Americans who are 18 to 20 years old actually vote. So yeah, that was all BS. Back to Dan Savage and his own BS.
And they're demanding what 90% of Americans say they want, including a majority of gun owners. Mandatory background checks, closing the gun show loophole, a ban on weapons of war like the AR-15.
The anti-gun big lie. First up, mandatory background checks and closing the gun show loophole are just different terms for the same anti-gun agenda item. And super tone-deaf calling for it while talking about a spree killing where the killer passed a background check because no other laws were being followed. But even when polls show universal background checks to be wildly popular, when the people actually vote on it, it only manages to pass in the most anti-gun states by a bare majority, and goes down in flames in every other place. So much that it really hasn't been a strong agenda item recently. As for banning AR-15s, where does he get this data? Aaron and I were bored to tears at the NRA convention looking at booth after booth of AR-15s. Gun makers aren't cranking out so many black rifles because it's fun. No, they're doing it to meet a market. That market may soon reach saturation. Or not, I personally have no idea. But even when that happens, there's a massive number of Americans who not only own AR-15s and similar rifles, but also know that this weapons of war line is nothing but crap. I'm going to leave it there for this week, and you'll hear part two next week. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Oy vey.
Oy vey is a great response to any of these audio fisks.
Yeah, there are some times that I just can't really formulate a coherent response. I just... Oh, it causes me pain, and I put my face in my hands, and I whimper until the bad person goes away. Because, I mean, at a certain point, you go, it would take me far too much effort just to educate you, and my time is more valuable than that.
But I sit back and think of podcasts. I go, oh, I could make some entertaining stuff out of this. Like, oh, thank you, Dan. This is wonderful. And then on top of that, I get to listen to his podcast. Again, I love this show. Like, if you're into, you know, talking about naughty bits and podcasts, like this is good. This is good podcasting to listen to.
I just don't understand why someone who has a talk show, podcast, whatever, about sex decides to talk about politics. I mean, if it was sexual politics, like the Sesta Fosta thing we talked about a couple weeks ago, all right, that's relevant. But what does the Second Amendment, what do all these mass shootings and doing nothing, what does that have to do with a podcast about sexuality?
Nothing at all. I haven't been listening to Dan long enough to know if this is true, but I've got to guess that originally his opening rant was designed for political talk of sexual nature. And that's actually 90% of his opening rants are political talk of sexual nature. But ever so often he will stray away, and gun control is one of the few issues where he will go off. And yeah, guns have nothing to do with sex whatsoever, despite, you know, what the people in Joe Huffman's Markley's Law segment have to say about it.
You know, I know at least one model of Oleg's who would beg to disagree.
Oh, I can only imagine. I can imagine.
I will keep this very circumspect for young ears. I'm just going to say that she found the front sight blade to be uncomfortable.
Oh, okay. That was not the direction I was going for on that. I was actually thinking more about that gentleman that poses for Oleg that you introduced me to at NRA.
No, he doesn't mix his sexuality with guns.
I was just thinking about the fact that the way he was talking and the stories he was telling, he's not compensating for anything. He likes guns, and it has nothing to do with that problem that whatsoever.
Speaking of people who are anti-gun, in this week's segment of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David talks about the chilly reception he received as a gun owner from childhood through adulthood.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. For those that think high school students protesting things they don't understand is anything new, back in the mid-80s, I experienced my fellow students protest the forming of a military history club. This happened at one of the most prestigious science high schools in New York City. We were called vile names, our meeting posters were vandalized or destroyed, and the other members of the club and I were harassed on and off school grounds. All of this was based on ignorance of what our club was about. Not, as they would have had you believe, in the glorification of war, but in the exploration and preservation of military history. However, after the first few meetings, the protesters lost interest, and the Military History Enthusiast Club met without incident for the rest of my time at that school. Keep in mind, nothing happens in a vacuum. Today's ignorant high school students become tomorrow's ignorant voters, and next week's ignorant politicians. These ignorant politicians, supported by those ignorant voters, pass ignorant laws, perpetuating the cycle of ignorance and further marginalizing law-abiding gun owners. In the mid-90s, I attended a lecture at Siena College discussing the proposed federal firearms ban. The presenter who supported the ban was smooth and charismatic and pushing the same false facts we all know so well now. He used talking points like, "A pistol grip makes it easier to shoot from the hip," and "These weapons serve no purpose but to kill children." The college students attending ate it up. Back then, there was no internet to check facts. These were new talking points, and clear counters for them were still being developed. The pro-gun rights presenter, on the other hand, arrived late, was unprepared, flustered, and made a hash of the whole thing. Not our finest hour. The late 90s were kind of interesting as a gun owner in New York. With the burgeoning hysteria about Y2K, I had some of my mildly anti-gun friends come to me for advice on buying their first gun so they could defend themselves when the system collapsed. I didn't ridicule them or dismiss them. I wasn't even tempted to. I gave them the best advice I could and offered to take them to the range with my guns before they decided on what to purchase. Of course, most of them never followed through, and the world didn't end on January 1st, 2000. However, a few did become gun owners, and after their experiences with the legal process, some of them even transitioned to the pro-gun position, so it is possible. Fast forward to early January 2017. I was at a wedding reception for a lesbian couple I know. They had decided to get married because they were concerned that President-elect Trump was going to ban gay marriage after he was sworn into office. During the reception, I was sitting at a table surrounded by good friends, some of whom I had known for many years. Suddenly, one of them called me out as a member of the NRA, implying that this was somehow something shameful. She then went on a several-minute, fact-free rant about assault weapons and the need for more and stricter firearms laws. My response was to tune her out, let her rant, and when she was done, I started a conversation about movies or food or something equally innocuous. Could I have handled this differently? Of course I could have. Would it have been productive? I don't think so. I could have countered each of her statements with facts. I could have referenced data from the New York State Department of Criminal Justice Services, the FBI, the CDC, or some other reputable source. However, considering the gish gallop of misinformation, false data, and CNN talking points, I would have needed a page or more of notes so I could address each point in turn. Had I done this, I would not have changed her opinion, nor the opinions of the others at the table who were nodding sagely in agreement with her statements. What I probably would have done was set some of them off and caused anger and bad feeling around the table. I have more respect for the newlyweds than to cause that at their wedding reception, so I kept my mouth shut and let it wash over me. To quote Dr. Thomas Sowell, It is usually futile to try to talk facts and analysis to people who are enjoying a sense of moral superiority in their ignorance. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So, yeah, me, Mr. Audiofisk guy, you would think I might actually be at odds at some of the statements here on this, but there is definitely times where you engage and you talk to the people, and there's other times when you go, no, this is a no-win situation. And I would definitely say at a wedding, that is not the time to get into a heated political discussion, because, yeah, that celebration's not about you. Like, he made absolutely the right move.
Yeah. Well, again, my favorite story is the one he told last week, where the woman said, "If I knew you were a gun owner, I wouldn't ask you for directions." And he replied, "Madam, if I knew you were anti-gun, I would have given you the directions anyway." That's so classy. Oh, that's beautiful. That's how you handle these things.
Yep.
I don't know if I would have the good grace to do that. I'm trying to remember that so I can have that level of grace when called upon.
It's kind of like what we do, you know, in the Second Amendment fight, is there are people out there that are trying to strip our rights to firearms away. And meanwhile, we are turning around and trying to give those rights to those very people that are trying to strip our rights, especially when you realize that being anti-gun is not really an American thing. It is there's pockets of anti-gun in this country, and those pockets often tend to be places that are very, very restricted of firearms. You know, we've got Michael Bloomberg's coming out of New York. You've got all the crazy gun laws coming out of California, all the horrible gun laws coming out of Chicago, all the terrible gun laws here in Massachusetts. We are giving rights to our enemies, and that's not the least bit of concern to me. Okay, time again for the house dick to spin us another yarn of life on the job and how bad things can go when you're a private investigator.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the next episode of Tales from the Trunk. This episode is brought to you on behalf of the free ice cream machine, which is broken. Now, I mentioned last week that it was a long, long week. I sounded tired, and I was, and I do apologize for that. This week, however, has been no better. I've managed about 70 hours in the field this week, with my first day off being Saturday. Each day I racked up probably close to 30 minutes to about an hour's worth of footage, all recorded in high def. So it leaves me with several hours of post-production to pull it from the camera and upload to secure servers prior to closing out the reports and handing them off to the client with their requisite hefty invoices. And while it's cost me in time outside of work, it's also cost me in tech. We've lost two tracking devices this week, and those are $400 a pop to replace, as I believe I've mentioned in earlier episodes. It's one of those costs of doing business, and I always happen to dread those calls or emails saying device was discovered and or device destroyed. There are some things that even Pelican cases can't protect from. Now, of course, sometimes I do feel like it's cheating to use devices like this, but it's usually done out of necessity with needing to either establish target patterns, new residences, or just for safety's sake, such as the gangbanger with a taste for violence who discovered not one, but two of our devices in prior work. We've recovered one and lost the other. But of course, that particular individual had a violent history towards all sorts of individual, both law enforcement and private citizen, with the rap sheet, you know, the proverbial mile long. It sounds cliche, but the dude was straight up dangerous. So for brevity's sake, when this episode does go live, guys, I'm going to share a cell phone video I took of to our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/assortedcalibers podcast, prior to my purchasing of a dash cam at the suggestion of friends, which now goes everywhere I go. This particular encounter happened, I'd say, probably 2 years ago now, shortly after setting up on a surveillance in a parking lot in perhaps the most dangerous neighborhood of Detroit, known as Brightmoor.
To preface the story, I was camped out in the Little Caesars parking lot watching the house of Target a short distance away. A gentleman in a Ford Focus shows up and happens to see me with my truck running, and he asks to borrow my phone to call a friend. For whatever reason, I don't know, I don't care, and I decline, and it quickly spiraled out of control from there. You should go watch the video. Now, generally, my encounters with folks, I try to keep brief, especially in the city of Detroit. I try to terminate any and all random contacts with people I meet. I learned my lessons after Saginaw. What the hapless hoodlum in the video I'll share didn't realize just off camera was my firearm and 15 rounds of hollow points, as well as in a second magazine. Now, I love the city of Detroit. I love its grit, its character, but I'm under no misguided notion that it's a safe place. Predators of both the two-legged and four-legged variety inhabit this city. Regular reports of coyotes and stuff like that snagging dogs. This happened to be in broad daylight, 8 o'clock in the morning, give or take, and the guy went from zero to crazy in a heartbeat. Now, to be fair, I did egg him on a bit, as you'll hear in the video. You gotta be tough to work in these towns, and you gotta be smart, and that perhaps was my best moment. Now, would this sort of thing fly in someplace like Compton? I doubt it. But I've been mistaken for law enforcement here in the area. Obviously, I don't claim to be, for obvious legal reasons. Now, suburbia, of course, I can let my guard down. But I have been pulled out of my car at gunpoint by law enforcement, particularly the city of Sterling Heights. That experience was about 10 or 11 years ago now, when I was just starting my career, and that was an encounter with a bunch of nervous city cops. So, you know, even in suburbia, things can go tits up in a hurry. So, again, guys, visit our Facebook page. You can reach me there directly with your questions, and it may become content for another segment on Tales from the Trunk. As always, don't forget to feed and water your favorite neighborhood trunk monkey. Donations of cash and ammo are always accepted, and you can get goodies if you sign up on our Patreon. So, go, sign up, give us a listen, subscribe, you know you want to. Later.
All right, we get a confession time. So at the time of this recording, Steven has not shared this video, and I am climbing the walls to see what's going on in this.
Me too, Weird. I can't wait to see it. I bet it's going to be awesome.
If you're on our Facebook group, which you should be a member of, you should be a member of our Facebook group. If you're seeing it, so are we. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all of our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels and the C5 lower giveaway from Frontier Armory in Las Vegas, Nevada. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at my nerd blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, and my emergency preparedness blog, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com.
You can hear more of Savage on the We Like Shooting podcast on the Firearms Radio Network. Special thanks to Nate Spencer for our wonderful music.
I have an AR-15, and he doesn't. Our calibers are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.